This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the first ever, possibly last ever, Sellers Points podcast, right here and only on placetobenation.com. That's placetobenation.com. You can find this podcast on the site, through iTunes, download it, stream it, however you want to listen to it. And with that, I can't believe they gave me my own show. The thing is, they're probably saying the same thing right now. But, for all intents and purposes, here I am to talk to you about all things comics, comic book movies, TV shows, stuff off the page, give you my own views on it and everything. And if you've probably been listening to these podcasts for a while, you've heard another podcast that's very similar to this that I am totally riding the coattails of. My good friends and cohorts over at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, that'd be Nick Duke and one Mr. Greg Phillips, who, surprise run-in, is joining me here today. Say hello to the people, Greg.
I can hear my entrance music playing in the background, and I'm coming out to make an impact.
And he always does. And let it be known that nobody, and I mean nobody, not even Ric Flair himself, flops like Greg.
That's exactly right. In fact, if there's one word that I would use to describe my life to this point, it would be flop.
he's always the proper denizen of self-deprecating humor, everyone. We all give Greg a big hand for that. But the truth is, like, Greg was actually very kind to join me on this inaugural Sellers Points podcast. And, you know, I want to say thanks again for that, buddy. I really do appreciate it. And
hey, no problem. I mean, you've helped us out of many a jam with our varied giant size projects we've done in the past, so it's the least I can do, man. Anytime.
Well, don't let me hold you to that. You're already overworked as it is. And it's kind of cool, though, you know, because you and I have been talking comics for, like, what, 12 years now?
Yeah, right at about 12 years, I would say, yep.
Yeah, like, we... funny story, not really funny story, I guess, it's just kind of informational for those who want to know what my pedigree is for comics. Like, why in the hell am I listening to this guy? I was total Marvel fanboy coming into college when I met Greg back in, like, 2004. And, like, I had just come back into comics reading a bunch of, like, Marvel Amazing Spider-Man. I'm going to give a shout to J. Michael Straczynski and John Romita Jr. for bringing me back after about a six-year hiatus. And then I met Greg at the illustrious Troy University down in Troy, Alabama.
Free. Be sure to check out our wonderful website, troy.edu/news, to read some of my handiwork.
Shameless self-promotion, shameless self-promotion. Yep. Say, if I could actually say that really quickly, it would be funnier. now... Greg was, like, all about some DC when I met him. Now, me being the kind of standard Marvelite, the guy who, like, had blinders on to the world, I only see things in shades of red and white, and that's not just because I'm an Alabama fan. I totally didn't buy that I was going to enjoy anything DC. And then Greg did the best thing he possibly could have done. He handed me Green Lantern Rebirth and Batman Hush. He said, take these home, read them, and get back to me. And when I did, I didn't really want to give the comics back. I kept reading them over and over and over again. And suddenly this whole new world just opened up to me, and I was just in it, man. I am total DC nerd all the way. Suddenly it was just like the blinders came off, the lights were on, and it was a beautiful... green-tinted world.
Yes, those are days I'll never forget. You turned me on to some Spider-Man stuff I had never read. I turned you on to some to the world of DC, and we never looked back. We became comic book brethren.
Exactly. It's always nice when you meet somebody who, like, you just kind of instantly click with them, and it's like this is like family. You know, it's like I found another, like, a brother from another mother, if you will, out there in the world, in all places. And we've been trading comic book knowledge, barbs, and everything else back and forth.
Trading books back and forth.
Yeah,
you became such a big DC fan by reading Rebirth and Hush, and then over the years you've lent me my share of books, and I've lent you your share of books, and it's pretty cool. I mean, that's what it's all about, man. Spreading the love of the genre spreading the love of the genre to somebody else, and you know, trading it back and forth, and finding out what things we loved along the way.
So. And that's the name of the game. That's what we're all here to do. And I would like to think that that's going to be the ultimate purpose of this podcast, is to kind of be an antithesis, if you will, to the larger, I don't want to say larger, but certainly louder, internet comics community who seem to hate everything. That's all you see anymore. Hatred. And folks, we can be better than that. We can all be better than that. So let's try. And I said, you know what? Let me put my money where my mouth is. Let me get out there and try to be better and tell people about some cool things. So without further ado, let's get into some cool stuff, Greg, because there's some cool stuff that happened this month.
Absolutely.
One of the first things I want to talk about is, getting a little nostalgic. I think you were probably a fan of this show back in the 80s like I was. A little show called Mask. It was a 1980s cartoon. It was based off of a toy line from Hasbro, like many shows at that time were, like G.I. Joe, Transformers, you know, the stuff like that. And Mask was one of those that was not all that popular. And I don't want to get into, like, was it mainstream, wasn't it, debate, because that could go on for hours. But it was one of those that really made an impression on me. My Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles addled mind saw this show on one day, and I was like, what is this? I've got to sit down and watch every episode of this that I possibly can. And, I mean, it became a staple of Saturday morning for me. And, Greg, you were a fan of this, yes?
Yeah, I remember watching it. Like, I wasn't like as devout a watcher of that as I was of the similarly acronymed Cops that came, I believe, a few years later.
Also a great show.
But I do remember watching it. And the main thing I remember about it is the lead group was Mask, which stood for Mobile. I can't remember the rest of it, but it was
Mobile Armored Strike Command, and Command spelled with a K because they were totally awesome for doing that back in the 80s before anybody thought to do it.
Exactly. They were ahead of their time in that way. But I remember they fought against the bad guys they fought against were called Venom, and they had like the best acronym ever for an evil group. They were the Vicious Evil Network of Mayhem.
And isn't that
that
brilliant?
Stood out to me all these years, because that's just like the most awesomely over the top villain name ever, and I'm surprised that comics never ripped it off, because that's a great name for an evil group. Way better than Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Isn't it? Like, it's like, man, whenever they made the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, it was like, did you guys even like really think about your name? And then when you get to the 80s, we get these people that made Mask, it's like, you know what? Vicious Evil Network of Mayhem. Venom. And
we're not just evil, we're vicious too.
Yes.
And we cause mayhem. And we have a network because we have friends, so.
And, you know, I mean, come on. This is just a winner. This is just a winning concept all the way around. I mean, it's one part Bond, it's one part Transformers, with a little G.I. Joe mix in there. But, you know, when I was watching this as a kid, I used to, like, go back and forth between, are these guys, like, government agents? Are they private contractors? I don't want to, like, accuse them of being Blackwater or anything, but, you know, there you go.
they may have been doing some under-the-table deals, but how were they funded? That was another question. But I remember their leader... Matt Tracker.
Oh,
Matt
yeah.
Matt Tracker was their leader, and he was like the every team in the 80s had to have that cool, like, leader out front, whether it was Duke for G.I. Joe, or whether it was arguably, you could argue that Leonardo, you know, was the leader of the Ninja Turtles.
Sure, Optimus Prime for the Transformers,
exactly. So, and Matt Tracker served that cool leader role that all the great 80s cartoons had.
And who didn't imagine, like, back in that day, you know, this was back when the DeLorean was such a big deal, like, Back to the Future was huge, you know, the doors that lift up and look like wings. Who didn't want the DeLorean to actually lift those wings up and actually fly?
I mean, it's the natural progression of things. It was a time when, you know, everything was based around toys to a degree, but it was also based around imagination, because basically, you know, if you're a kid, these are things that you thought of when you're a kid, and the shows of that era would show you these things that you imagined, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if, and then insert thing here, and then 2 weeks later there's a cartoon on syndicated TV showing you what you just imagined.
And that's great. That's exactly what we wanted it to be, though. You know,
it was
everything. I mean, you see that car's doors open up, and you're like, "Oh, what's this about to do?" And then it freaking flies.
Yep.
That sold me on it immediately. But anyway, this week, or last—I guess it was last week now—IDW, who has all these different licensed properties from like Transformers, G.I. Joe, basically the Hasbro line, as well as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is an awesome book if you haven't read it. And my personal favorite, their Ghostbusters line, which has just been freaking phenomenal. They announced that they're bringing Mask back as an ongoing comic series from writer Brandon Easton and artist Tony Vargas. Now, I will admit that I'm not as familiar with these guys' work, but the first piece of art that came out for it just looked awesome. Really reminded me a lot of like Sean Murphy. And they're saying that they're kind of giving it a little 21st century upgrade, and even going so far as to say it's getting a Fast and Furious twist. What are your thoughts on that, Greg?
I'm kind of two minds about it, because on the one hand, I wonder what the audience is, because, you know, we were kids at that time, certainly. But it does appeal to our childhood. But on the other hand, I think it's great, because I think that when you mention that Fast and the Furious twist, that's kind of – I think when you modernize concepts like this, that's kind of how you have to approach it. You have to think of, like, you know, what are some contemporary things in culture that are succeeding, and how can we integrate those ideas into this old idea without sacrificing what the original idea was. And I think the original idea was these cool vehicles, cool contraptions used in an espionage nature, and – what was cool in the 80s was DeLoreans and, you know, big trucks and stuff like that. Well, fast forward to today, and the Fast and the Furious franchise is very popular and has kind of rejuvenated interest in the, for lack of a better term, the car genre. So
genre!
I think it can turn out to be a good idea, because a lot of these concepts, when you try to update them, they don't work, because they don't really understand what that means. It doesn't mean sacrificing what the original idea was and going with something totally different. In this case, I think it's just, to me, an evolution of the original idea.
Cue up the Motorhead music.
Evolution is a mystery!
Yes. See, there are going to be wrestling references on this show.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And eventually we'll get to my Big E impression, but maybe not this time, maybe later.
I'll look forward to that.
Yeah. Nobody should look forward to that. But it's going to happen anyway, because, you know, because New Day Rocks.
Day Rocks.
New Day Rocks. We'll keep that going for hours too, folks, so we got to move on. But that gives you a hint and kind of an insight into like mine and Greg's fandom coming straight out of the 80s. I mean, everything 80s, right? I mean, that was right. The time we grew up. That was our cartoons. Saturday morning.
Yeah, it was our. It was the. In many ways, these are the shows that helped raise us. So
precisely, like it was like when our parents wanted to sleep in, because let's face it, we were holy terrors as children. The Saturday morning cartoons, they were there for us. And you know what else was there for us in the 80s? How's this for a segue? Superman.
Oh, yeah.
The 1980s Superman. I speak specifically of two guys. One, John Byrne, who I'm not going to discuss any further because, well, he doesn't deserve any more press. And Dan Jurgens, a guy who actually deserves a whole lot more press. And that's kind of our, you know, our segue, if you will, into DC Rebirth and the return of that 1980s Superman. The Superman from the pre-Flashpoint universe is back, is going to be the Superman starring in the main Superman book and in Action Comics, which is also returning to its original numbering. Now, if you're like me, you're also a fan of the New 52 Superman, and you're kind of sad to see him go. But at the same time, it's hard not to be excited about the pre-Flashpoint Superman coming back, and especially with the pre-Flashpoint Lois Lane in tow and their son, John Kent, as the new Superboy. And there's a current comic book series out there right now called Lois and Clark, or Superman Lois and Clark. That's all about them. It's a little mini-series by Dan Jurgens and the just incomparable, amazing artist Lee Weeks. And it's easily the best Superman book on the shelf right now. You got to get it. It's just the Superman book. If you're a Superman fan from any era, I don't care who you are, pick up this book. Why? I don't know why you would miss it.
Seconded.
There he is. See, this is just exactly what I wanted out of a Superman book. And the thing is, like, I've been a big fan of some of the things of the New 52 Superman. I'm not going to say that it's all been roses since he came in. Certainly not. I mean, Scott Lobdell was writing the book for a little while, and I think we all know how I feel about him. And his turn on Superman, which was pretty much garbage. Some unfortunate missteps, you know, here and there, but there were bright spots too. Greg Pak and Aaron Cooter had a great run on Action Comics. And as of right now, I'm actually really enjoying Peter Tomasi writing all four of the current Superman books, and I'm looking forward to him taking on the main title in Rebirth. But Greg, you and I both being fans of that Dan Jurgens Superman, that 80s, 90s feel for Superman, do you think this is the secret to getting people to really like the character again and to want to buy his comics in the DC Rebirth universe?
I think that it's part of the answer. The answer is not necessarily tied to a specific era, I don't think, or a specific decade. I think it's tied to a specific feel and a specific approach to this character and this universe. And I think one of the ideas of Rebirth is to get a lot of readers back that have hemorrhaged in recent years before, and then refocusing and then hoping you can turn that into new reader momentum as well. But I'll tell you why I think it is not, again, not necessarily tied to the fact that it's 80s, 90s Superman, but the way that those books were written and the way that the character was presented at that time. It comes down to a couple of things. Number one, and I'm going to mention this first because it doesn't get a lot of play, supporting cast. Those Superman books in the 80s and 90s had, to me, the best overall supporting cast of any comics that I think I've ever read. I mean, you go down the roster and you had, because you had such a wide array of writers at that time writing the character, but you had, you know, Jonathan and Martha Kent, you had Lois, you had Jimmy, you had Perry White, you had Lana, you had Cat Grant, you had Jose Delgado, you had Bibbo, you had Lex and his various assistants, Emil Hamilton. It was a cornucopia of interesting characters that, and here's the key part, all had important things to do in the storyline. They all interacted with each other. They all interweaved through the main thread of the books. And I think that is something that has kind of been lost in recent years, is that importance of that supporting cast, the marginalization at times of some of the major supporting characters in Superman books. And I think that's something that will come back. And I think that also the basic heart and premise of Superman as the best hero that there is, the best person that there is in the DCU. The DC counterpoint to Captain America, of the guy that when push comes to shove, this is the guy that you want as your hero. This is the guy that you want protecting you and defending you, because even if he screws up, he's always going to try to do the right thing, and he's going to try to do the right thing for somebody else and not for himself. And I think that these are all things that are going to be brought back with this character, and I think these are all things that Dan Jurgens specializes in.
Absolutely. He kind of like made that popular again, you know, because there was a time when it seemed like people were getting a little burnt out on that, but Dan Jurgens has time and time again shown that you absolutely can and even should have that as part of who Superman is at all times, no matter what take you're using.
Exactly.
And when you look at some of the stories from the New 52, I like to bring up Scott Snyder and Jim Lee's Superman Unchained as a good example of this. It had that. It had some really great moments for Lois, for Jimmy, for Lex especially. Lex had some of the best moments in that whole series.
Mm-hmm.
You had, like you said, a supporting cast that felt real, that felt important, that felt like it always had something to do and there was always something going on. And, I mean, not to mention Jim Lee's art doesn't hurt.
No, not at all. And I think part of Superman's value is it, and part of the trick of telling a good Superman story is, to me, Superman is the most relevant and the most important when you see him reflected through other people and how other people view him and interact with him. And I think that when you minimize the supporting cast, you kind of lose that, because Superman is a symbol. It means a lot to a lot of people in real life, and he means a lot to the people in the DC universe. And I've always thought that having a supporting cast around him is essential, because you have to see through their eyes what Superman is and what he represents and what he makes them want to be.
And that's a good way to look at it. Like, it's better whenever, like, I mean, people are always going to project their own views onto Superman, and everybody's got their own favorite version of the character, to which there have been literally dozens, maybe more than that, maybe closer to, like, I don't know if we could say hundreds, but dozens sounds better.
Mm-hmm.
And every writer and artist puts their own spin on Superman, from alternate reality Superman, to like stuff that's been considered main continuity. But, I mean, one thing that I can say that never seems to change about Superman, no matter which version of him we're talking about, he's always that guy who is trying to do the right thing.
Yep.
I can actually say that for every version of Superman I've ever read. And even though sometimes what he thinks is the right thing is not necessarily the actual right thing, but, you know, that's the curse of being human, the curse of having to make choices. And he's... I make no secret that in the last few years he has really kind of become my favorite character again, and I wax and wane with that character like I did as a kid. Like, there were times whenever I was a huge Superman fan, and then I'd switch over to Batman, swing back over to Spider-Man, and I see what I did there. And then, you know, I discovered X-Men, and it was just all downhill from there. But anyway, I'm pretty excited about this rebirth deal. Like, seeing Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason back together to write and to co-write and to have Patrick Gleason's art at least every other issue on Superman, also with Doug Monke coming in to, you know, assist, since it is going to be a twice monthly book. That's right, not bi-weekly. That makes it sound like it's like coming out twice a week. I'm sorry, my journalism nerd thing is kicking in. But yes, that's what I have looked forward to so much for the last couple of months. Ever since it was announced, I've just been on cloud nine that this is going to be the team that gave us such a great Batman and Robin run during the New 52. Back together, it's kind of like getting the band back together, you know?
Oh yeah, totally. I agree. I think Rebirth is for a lot of us anyway, is a long-awaited recharge in terms of what of our pull lists in particular. Like, I don't do single issue comics as much as I used to, but I've got more comics added to my list for Rebirth than I have had maybe ever, not at least since I was a kid. And even then, I didn't even have a pull list. I just got them off the shelves. Probably the most I've ever had on my pull list, because I've always been a trade waiter, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
And in this case, I'm starting at the ground floor in a lot of these comics because I love a lot of the premises, and especially the Superman line. I've got, I believe, 4 Superman books on my pull list for the month of June. So. Or July, I think it is. So
it's hard to turn down some of these books. I mean, I'm even interested in Gene Yang's new Superman, which I didn't think I would be. I mean, I like the guy a lot. I actually thought that his Superman run, brief as it was, would have been served better if he hadn't been immersed in a giant crossover at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But his new book actually sounds, you know, it sounds more like it's in his wheelhouse. And you know, the premise is interesting, so I'm at least, you know, interested to try out issue 1. You know, we'll see if it brings me back. And Phil Jimenez doing the new Superwoman title and making Lois Lane, you know, the new Superwoman. That's as much as we know about it, honestly, because they haven't really given us a lot of information on that.
Yeah, we don't even know which Lois it is.
No, we don't. We don't know if it's you know, the new 52 Lois, or if it's the you know, pre-Flashpoint Lois. But those aren't even the only super books that are coming out. Later in the year, we're going to have a new Supergirl title from Steve Orlando that I'm pretty pumped for, because I've really enjoyed Steve Orlando on Midnighter, and I'm so happy he's sticking around in DC, because the guy's a really talented writer. And then we don't know the creative team on it yet, but you can't tell me that the premise for Super Sons doesn't just scream must buy.
That's on my list. Yeah. I'm going to be checking it out. I am a fan of Damian, and you know, I think he adds intrigue. And I'm a huge fan of John Kent. He's been a great addition to the DCU in the Lois and Clark book.
Oh, absolutely! Like, he is. He is phenomenally written, especially by Dan Jurgens. Anyway, I hope that whoever picks that book up, like picks up that character, can really run with it. And we're going to get to see Peter Tomasi writing the character in Superman, because that's the very first arc, is the, you know, pre-Flashpoint Superman trying to teach his son how to use his powers, his newly like developing powers. So,
and we've seen in the past that Tomasi knows how to write the father-son dynamic really well.
Yeah, he does. Like, few people really seem to like really grasp how to write that properly, but Tomasi knocked it out of the park with his Batman and Robin run. I thought that only Grant Morrison could really write Damian all that well, but then when Tomasi wrote him, I was like, nope, Tomasi might actually be the definitive guy for Damian now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping, you know, lightning will strike twice, or they can capture it in a bottle, or whatever it is you do with your lightning. I hope that it's...
Ride it, even.
Or if you want to ride it, or, you know, if you want to pull a William Wallace with it, there you go. Somebody's going to catch that reference, and they're going to...
I caught it.
I know you caught it, but somebody else is going to laugh about that, and I hope that they do. So that represents some really great ideas coming out of comics right now. And now we're going to do the thing that I'm not going to hate on this too much, because I don't want to make Ben Morse mad. Actually, he's probably going to be mad anyway. But I'm going to invite him on the show one day, folks, because I really want to know how I pronounce Esad Ribic's or Ribic. Ben, please come on the show, and let's just do an entire segment on how you pronounce some of these artists' names.
Thank you. If you do that, Russell, I can promise you I will promote that on every social media on demand, because inquiring minds have to know how some of these artists' names are pronounced.
And Ben Morse, I know you know every one of these guys, and I've talked to them. You know how to pronounce their names. I mean, that's all the segment will be. It's just you coming on here and telling me how dumb I am for not knowing how to pronounce these people's names, and then like teaching us all how to do it. I mean, I can make a 30-minute podcast out of that. So
I'm picturing a montage that shows Ben, you know, standing at the front of the class with like a pointer pointing to the chalkboard, leading us through enunciation lessons. And meanwhile, we're back there with like, in our lab coats with beakers pouring chemicals into each other and kind of stroking our chins, watching on.
And I'll be so happy to have it, as a recording so that I can always call back to it and be like, anytime I start to say something wrong, because I will always default back to bad habits because I'm old. And I'm going to need some kind of point of reference. So this is my plea. Ben, come on. I know I'm about to hate on some Marvel stuff here, but please don't take offense, because before I get into that, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you that if you're not buying the Mighty Thor or Jason Aaron's Star Wars or Kieran Gillen's Darth Vader series, you guys are just wasting your money at the comic shop. Go buy all three of those. Do that right now. And while you're at it, don't miss out on Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. That's one I know how to pronounce. Wait till Ben gets on the show and then tells me I was an idiot and did it wrong. And then I'm gonna feel foolish. But in any case, Old Man Logan, that has got to be one of the best things running right now. So there it is. I'm giving my shill for the Marvel books that I think are absolutely freaking fantastic.
And credit to Marvel, by the way, for doing a great job of nabbing great writers and putting great creative teams together. I got to give them their props, because they've got a loaded roster right now.
They really do. They are so stacked, and nothing pisses me off more than seeing Jason Aaron as an exclusive to Marvel. I'm like, you bastards, you've really got him locked in, don't you? But that's all right. He's a Southern bastard, you see.
Yes.
See what I did there?
Yes, I do.
Shouts to Southern Bastards as being the absolute best comic on the shelf. Jason Aaron, Jason Latour, go get that. But both of those guys are doing some pretty cool things over at Marvel. Jason Latour's got Spider-Gwen going on. That's been a pretty good book as it's gone on. Pretty much the entire Spider-Man line has been good for quite some time. How's this for a segue? But there's something coming up. That I'm just not feeling this whole Dead No More thing and the revival of Gwen Stacy. Now, granted, I don't have a lot of information to go on here, but there are certain sacred cows, if you will, and this sacred cow moves loudly, and I think the milk is going to turn sour here. Is that enough metaphor? I think I've milked this metaphor for all it's worth.
We're going down the well of metaphor right now. You're weaving quite the poem here, actually. No,
I think I've milked this one for all it's worth. So I'll just say this. Bringing back Gwen Stacy, Dan Slott, that's a mistake. And here's why. And I'm going to get on DC for doing something very similar. When DC brought back Jason Todd, they did it in a pretty great story called Under the Red Hood. And they found a way to bring Jason back that made a whole lot of sense, regardless of that whole Superboy Prime punching a hole in reality and upsetting the whole balance and all that crap. I'm not saying that was a good idea. I'm just saying that the way that story was handled by the masterful Judd Winnick, who is sorely missed, by the way, at DC, by me, maybe a few others, he found a way to turn Jason into an antagonist that continued to play on Bruce's guilt. Because if you think about it, Bruce Wayne had gotten to the point in his life where he had started to kind of get past his parents' death. The event that had defined him, that had made him Batman for so long, was starting to kind of, starting to wane a little bit, if you will. Wane, huh? Pun. And that was one I didn't mean to do. And what happens after that is, of course, a death in the family, where Jason Todd is murdered by the Joker. Batman lost a Robin because he wasn't there for his partner. And the guilt of that is what pushed him to continue being Batman. It's what kept him in that zone. That's a death that, unlike his parents, really was on him. That was his fault. There was no getting around that. So that guilt translates into, I must continue to be Batman. And when you bring a character like that back, you run into the danger of hitting that spot in storytelling that says, in the reader's mind, why does the hero even continue doing this? If you're bringing these characters back from the dead, and death is meaningless, why do they even continue? I mean, we all know that death is a revolving door in comics, but you know, certain deaths have become so integral to their characters that undoing them kind of undoes a lot of their reasoning to continue on. And in this particular case, Red Hood specifically, Jason Todd, it was handled pretty well, because when Jason came back from the dead, he was a stone cold killer, which flies in the face of everything that Bruce and Batman stood for at that point, and still stands for today. So when Bruce finds out that this new Red Hood who's out there just murdering criminals is actually Jason Todd, and even has that just mind-blowingly amazing confrontation between Jason the Joker and Batman, when Jason pleads for Batman to kill the Joker, it all kind of comes to a head that Jason is using all of Batman's training to go out there and murder people. Even though it's people that are considered criminals, he's not just like a serial killer, although, you know, he's a serial killer who targets criminals. That still, like, that in Batman's mind means that Bruce is going to hold himself responsible for this. And where DC has actually royally screwed up with the Jason Todd character is they've put him back in the Bat family. They have made him a hero again, and he and Bruce are all hunky-dory getting along, even though Jason is still carrying guns and shooting people. It's like, at what point did this happen? When did this suddenly become okay? Why is Bruce okay with this? How is he not hunting Jason like Jason is a criminal? I mean, that was the premise they started with. That was the road that Judd Winnick put them on, and they went the other way. And it's like, okay, well, if he's just welcomed Jason back into this, does Bruce even feel the weight of his own guilt and responsibility here anymore? Because it kind of seems like he doesn't. And that, to me, is a little bit of a violation of the character. Now, on the Spider-Man end, you're bringing Gwen Stacy back. A death that Spider-Man, that Peter has held himself responsible for forever. This is one that he's never going to let go. But Uncle Ben has stuck with him, and he promised himself that it would never happen again, but when it happened to his girlfriend, you want to talk about a gut-wrenching moment in comics. You want to talk about, like, the gut-wrenching moment in comics. And if this is really Gwen, if this is really Gwen coming back from the dead, this is not the route to go. I mean, how are you going to juggle this one? How are you going to make this actually work and not just seem like fan service of, oh, well, Gwen's super popular right now because of books like Spider-Gwen or Gwenpool or any number of, like, Gwen Stacy characters. Not that I have a problem with that at all, because I'm a big Gwen fan myself. But her death means something. Her death means something to me. It means something big to the Peter Parker character. This wasn't just a death that was thrown in there. Or it's not one that seems like it was just for the hell of it. This is a death that carries real weight. She is a character who, despite being dead and gone, her presence is felt. It's like a weight on Peter's shoulders. How can you undo this? And Greg, I've rambled on for a little while here. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm with you. I'm with you on this. On the one hand, bringing characters back from the dead as a gimmick almost never works. There are exceptions.
There always are.
Something like Marvel Zombies, something like Blackest Night worked. But again, Blackest Night was never built on the premise of these characters are actually coming back. It was built on the premise of distorted, undead versions of these characters are coming back with the express purpose of playing on the emotions of the loved ones that lost them. I'm okay with that. If that's where this is going, I'm okay with it. If the premise of Dead No More is actually Dead No More, if you're actually bringing back all of these people that Peter has lost, particularly Gwen, who other than Uncle Ben is the most important person that he's lost, I would argue. I think that's a huge mistake. And it's hard for me to comment too exclusively on his run from a reader's perspective because I haven't read a lot of Dan Slott's Spider-Man run. But from the outside looking in, it looks awfully similar to stuff like Spider-Verse or like Spider-Island. You know, everybody gets spider powers. There are a ton of Spider-Men. And it almost feels like you're just moving on to the next big, for lack of a better term, gimmick event where it's like, okay, well now we're going to bring back all of these people. And also, right now, Spider-Man is an industrialist. He's successful. And now you're going to bring back his long-dead first real girlfriend. And to me, part of the premise of Spider-Man was always, you know, the quote-unquote Parker luck. Yeah. And if you so what's he got to, what's Spider-Man really got to complain about these days when you've got millions of dollars, you're super successful.
Another wrestling reference. Millions of dollars.
And your long-dead girlfriend has come back. You know, it's like, it would be like after the big Brock Lesnar-John Cena match at SummerSlam 2014 when Lesnar squashed Cena, it would be like Cena coming out the next night on Raw and beating Lesnar and winning the title back.
It kills
the story because the premise is, how am I going to overcome this failure? With Peter, the idea is the Parker luck thing is Peter has always been probably the most relatable character in comics in terms of the general comic book reading audience because he has always had bad luck, but he knows he learns how to deal with that bad luck and he learns how to, you know, look at the bright side of life. But he's us.
And
it's not about making things easy for him. You know?
That's what Peter's always been. That's what he was for me. Because as you know, maybe the readers or listeners here don't know. I keep calling them readers because I'm used to writing this thing. But listeners, the first superhero I ever loved was Spider-Man. That's what made my interest in superheroes in the first place. And I saw myself in Peter Parker. I mean, he's a great everyman character. He does exactly what he's supposed to do. And credit to Dan Slott, I actually really dig this idea of Peter being an industrialist. I felt like that was a good progression of his character. Finally, we moved Peter forward. We moved him into some new facet of life, and he's actually using that big scientific brain of his for something other than, you know, a punching bag for whoever the next supervillain is. And it's worked out pretty well. Dan introduced some new characters that I really dug. I really enjoyed the Spider-Verse event, honestly, which, you know, as events go, you wouldn't think I would, but I did. I was shocked as everybody. And I think that Dan actually has a really good voice for Peter, which is one of the primary things that so many people, like in bad Spider-Man stories, one of my primary complaints is that the person just didn't have a good voice for Peter. They didn't really get how he thought or how he would react to things. But Dan Slott doesn't have that problem. Like, he totally gets how Peter would react to things. I'm just not totally sold on some of his plot points. And that's really where I am on this whole Dead No More thing. Because Spider-Man is still, he's still going to be my favorite character no matter what. But I'm just not on board with this. This just seems like a misstep. And one more thing that is, I mean, I hate to call back to it, but this is going to get one more day'd. When the next creative team comes on, I would just about bet anything that this is not going to work out the way they think it is, and they're going to wind up like slowly retconning this one back, or maybe they just pull the plug on it altogether. But what do I know? I'm just a a loudmouth comic book fan who sits over here and complains about stuff.
It does seem. I mean, Dan Slott's going on what I believe 5 or 6 years as the main Spider-Man writer.
He's been on it for a while now, and
it feels an impressive run. Good run. That's great. I mean, good for him. But at a certain point, it almost becomes time for another voice to be heard. You know,
it does. I really do feel like it's time for a new person to come in, try their hand at Spider-Man, and like move him into some kind of like. Some new territory, you know, try something different. I don't know who I would recommend, Jason Aaron, I'm kind of at a loss for a name, Jeff Lemire. I'm sorry, I have a cold, as it were.
Or even like going back to the approach of having, you know, multiple Spider-Man books, you know, and that kind of do their own thing. You know, you can have Dan do Amazing and have somebody else do like the adjectiveless Spider-Man or something, or spectacular Spider-Man.
Well, on that note, you know, Brian Michael Bendis is doing a Spider-Man book that's starring Miles Morales. And
yes, and I've heard good things about it.
What I've read of that book has been outstanding. I mean, from the Ultimate Universe to the main continuity, Brian Michael Bendis hasn't really, you know, missed a beat, but I mean, he created Miles Morales, so I would expect him to be able to write the character pretty well. And, you know, book's doing great. That's another one that I'll shill for. You know, guys, go out there and spend your money on some Spider-Man, the adjectiveless Spider-Man. No, it doesn't actually have that in the title. It's just called Spider-Man. And don't forget the hyphen. But that's our shill on stuff from comics this week, and Greg, I think it's about time we took a break. What do you think?
I think that's probably a good time. Time to pay those gimmicks they call bills.
Yeah, we got to go. Let the bean counters do their thing and shill some advertising to you. We're gonna take a break, but when we come back, we're gonna get into some movie talk. That's what you all came here to hear. we're gonna talk Batman v Superman versus Captain America Civil War. No, I'm not really going to do that. We are going to talk about both those movies and some stuff that's coming up, some cool stuff that's happened with both major studios. And who knows what else we're going to get into. I mean,
maybe a little Weekend at Bernie's. You never know.
You know what? So long as we get there, we're also going to like go into Weekend at Bernie's too. Most of you probably didn't even watch that one, but it's an underrated classic. But anyway, folks, stay tuned. We will be right back right here, only placetobenation.com.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back! The Sellers Point Podcast returns. You thought we were gone, or you were hoping. I don't know. You're still here, so that's great. Welcome back to the second half of the first ever Sellers Point Podcast, Episode 1, not The Phantom Menace, but although it may be as divisive. And I'm here with one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, also from PlaceToBeNation.com. This is a Place to Be Network podcast, by the way. But Mr. Greg Phillips, welcome back.
If this is episode one, I am certainly the Jar Jar Binks to your Qui-Gon Jinn.
Oh, no. I think we're both pulling some Jar Jar here.
we're those other pod racers in the pod race scene.
Hey, but if the internet is to be believed, we're both actually Sith Lords in disguise, and that this is all part of the grand plan. That's how it was, right? That makes it more palatable.
There's always some secret fanboy theory going on for all the insignificant characters in the background of every movie. So
they're just trying so hard to make episode one not suck. But let's just face facts, folks. Let's just all get together. Let's all have a little group hug, cry it out. Episode one was terrible. So was two, and let's be honest, so was three. But guess what? We got great Star Wars going on again. So it's all good. All good. We can all be happy again. Yay. But let's move into something else that was also divisive. Batman v Superman. Now, most of you folks out there, if you're listening to this, if you're a regular PlaceToBeNation.com viewer, reader, maybe you're a new person, I don't know. But if you know me, then you already know I reviewed this movie already. And you can find my review on PlaceToBeNation.com. And full disclosure, I gave it a 4 stars out of 5. It gave me a lot of what I wanted. Not saying it's not a flawed movie. It certainly is. It's certainly going to be a divisive movie, and it has been. But that's not the subject for right now. The subject right now is defining this movie's success. And let's not live in an alternate universe where you spend $250 million of production money, and then your movie goes on to make, getting on up there, close to $870 million at the box office, and we don't call that a success. Let's not live in that reality. Let's live in actual reality, where you turn out that kind of money, your studio is going to be fairly happy. Maybe not as happy as they would like to have been, but they're not going to be, like, down in the dumps about it. So, Greg, how would you define this movie's success? What do you see it as?
I see the movie as pretty much in any way you look at it, it's got to be defined as a financial success. I mean, when you look at the amount of money that it made, 800 some odd million dollars on a 250 some odd million dollar budget. Maybe you add another 100,000 on that for advertising costs.
Well, let's be fair. The real truth is that it's probably closer to like between 80 and 90 million, maybe $100 million at most for advertising and marketing, because I mean this movie was everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they had advertising partners too who also paid in to have their products in the movie.
Right. So and then you look at that, and then you look at, and this is all box office receipts, by the way. This is not counting home video.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten to that part yet.
When that comes out, that'll make, I don't know how much more money extra on top of that, because every person that buys the DVD or Blu-ray, that's going to be another roughly $20, $30 you know, going towards the movie for each person that gets it, plus all the merchandise that was sent out that, that benefits the movie,
sure,
that people bought. So, you know, I, there's no way to say that it's not a success by any means. You know, do I think that WB thought it would make more money than it did? Probably, because they have a history of overestimating projections and then overreacting when the projections don't go according to plan. But
They definitely did. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that the executives over at Warner Brothers, not DC Comics, Warner Brothers, they're the ones that made the movie.
Right.
They definitely said, our movie is going to do some Avengers numbers. And for reference, Avengers made like $1.4 billion, billion with a B at the box office. That's just the first one. And they, when they made Batman v Superman, they were thinking, this is the movie that fans have been clamoring for since the 1990s, since the birth of the internet. I remember sitting around with my buddies just clamoring for that movie. Mm-hmm. And it never happened. But now it did. And everybody has been building this movie up in their mind for a couple of decades now, and we all had expectations of what it was going to be. And, of course, we got something that probably didn't meet a lot of those expectations.
But I think that the other thing to keep in mind is there's a real danger in setting $1 billion as being your expectation for a movie, because people forget what $1 billion represents.
That's a lot of money, and there are only like five comic book movies that can say they've reached
it. They can say they've reached that, and it's very elite company. The other thing is the Avengers made $1 billion. I believe Iron Man 3 did. I believe Age of Ultron did. But Here's the thing. The Avengers was not the first Marvel movie.
No.
The Avengers was not the second Marvel movie. The Avengers had been built to for five years heading into
that. Well, it was
that.
Five movies, only 4 years
over 4 years. With the DC Extended Universe movies, we've basically gotten two. This was the second one. So to set your standard that you think the second movie in your franchise is going to make $1 billion, not that that's never happened, because I think The Dark Knight might have hit $1 billion. I'm not 100% sure.
The Dark Knight did, as did The Dark Knight Rises.
But those are almost exceptions, because The Dark Knight was the first comic book movie to get, like, you know, Oscar buzz and all that other stuff. There was a lot of mitigating factors around that.
There's also a lot of mystique around that movie, and I hate to put it this way, but because of Heath Ledger's death, really added a new layer to that movie's story.
There was so much buzz going into that for a lot of factors, and you can't set that as your baseline expectation, because that's not fair to anybody making the movie. Because if you're telling, you're basically telling everyone working on that movie, okay, if you don't make again $1 billion. If you don't make $1 billion, you're a failure, essentially, which is ridiculous. The movie is absolutely a financial success, and I think it's going to do even better when it comes on video.
I do too. I think that extended version is going to be like a huge boom for them. I think that's going to make it may even make some of the detractors a little happier. But there is an unreasonable expectation, and maybe WB shot themselves in the foot with this one by even suggesting that they were aiming for that $1 billion mark.
Yep.
I mean, I think you could leave that unsaid. I think you could just say, all right, we're going to go out there and our movie is going to make what it's going to make. We're not saying that we demand that it make $1 billion or that we're going to guarantee it makes $1 billion. We're going to go out there, we're going to produce the best movie possible, and it will return what it returns.
Exactly. And that's the way to approach it. The way to approach it is to make the best movie you can possibly make. Don't put an expectation, even if you have an expectation, don't put it out there in the public. Don't go out and crow about it. Don't go out there and, you know, make it known to the people that are working on the movie that this is the expectation. The people that are working on a movie don't need to be thinking about how much money it's going to make at the box office. They need to be thinking about what's the final product going to be. How is this going to turn out? They all need to be working towards the same goal. And if you put it in the mind of, well, gosh, we've got to move X number of tickets or else we're all going to be fired. You know, that's not that I'm saying that's the case here, but no. I'm just saying expectations, I think, were unrealistic. I still think the movie's a success financially anyway. I mean, it's certainly a divisive movie, but I think that the movie succeeded despite that, because $850, $60 million, I can name you a bunch of comic book movies that wish they could have hit that level. So,
and two of them are Iron Man movies.
Yeah, movies that had big budgets too. There's franchises that are continuing on right now that have had movies with huge budgets that didn't make half of what Batman v Superman made. So I think the movie is 100% a financial success. Now it's not a smash. I don't think it's an overwhelming smash hit, but it's absolutely a success.
Oh, it definitely is. And if you want to put it in context, the last time that that Warner Brothers tried a Superman movie, the flop that was Superman Returns, and let's not call it anything else, because that movie's production budget was $270 million, plus whatever they had to spend in advertising. Its total domestic gross was just over $200 million, with a worldwide take of $391 million. And no wonder that movie didn't get a sequel. That's lost money. There's no way that's not lost money. WB would have looked at that and said, huh, maybe that's not what people want. But then they look at how much money Man of Steel made, and they look at how much Batman v Superman made. They're obviously not sitting back saying, huh, this is exactly what people want, because, I mean, it's not like they ignored the critic reviews themselves. They read it. They saw it. They are well aware of it. But they are still going to say to themselves, we might not have hit the button that people are really wanting, but we're closer. If we weren't, we wouldn't see returns like this. And, you know, that's all part of it. That's all part of, like, trying to build a larger universe, is to, you know, some people will describe it as throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks, but quite frankly, isn't that the creative process? Isn't that what we do? I mean, I'm speaking like as a wannabe creator, isn't what you do? You try things that feel like they work to you. They feel like they're, you know, right on the money, and you see what people's response are. Because, I mean, how are you going to know what people's response are until you put it out there? I mean, these people are not mind readers. They're doing the best they can with what they have, and trying desperately not to look like copycats. Because I've heard the criticisms 1,000 times. They should just make their movies like Marvel makes theirs. And I'm like, and then you shift the criticism to being, they're a bunch of, if you will, let me be Pappy O'Donnell for a moment, we'd be a bunch of Johnny-come-latelys. And that doesn't work. You have to do something to separate yourself from the pack and to do something different. And
this might not
necessarily be the absolute best thing they could have done, but like I said, it's a learning process. And I thought that there were a lot of improvements, honestly, from Man of Steel to Batman v Superman, certainly in the way that dialogue was delivered. I thought that Chris Terrio's writing was stronger than what David Goyer's was, but that's just me.
And I think that the coming out of the gates with these huge expectations is such a and in any event, setting your expectations in terms of money instead of in terms of quality is a mistake, because when they come in and they're like, hey, we're going to make $1 billion, you know who didn't go in saying that? Sony, when they hired Sam Raimi to direct the first Spider-Man movie. Fox, when they hired Bryan Singer to direct the first X-Men movie.
Or even Warner, Disney, when they hired Jon Favreau to direct Iron Man.
Direct Iron Man, exactly. Or certainly even Warner Brothers itself, when they brought in Nolan to do Batman Begins. These were movies that were made by directors who were given freedom to make the kind of movie that they wanted to make. And what do you know? People liked it, and people turned out for the sequels in even greater droves than the first one. And I think that, and I hope that is going to be the case with Warner Brothers, where they don't overreact, because I think there is a history of about close to 10 years of Warner Brothers as a studio overreacting to things, both positively and negatively.
Wow.
So I'm really hoping that they just calm down and they look at it and they say, look, forget what people are saying. This movie worked on some level.
So when you say overreact, tell the people what you mean by that. Like, what do you see as an overreaction?
I'll give you, in my opinion, the biggest example. There's been a couple of examples with projects that were scrapped. Joss Whedon's Wonder Woman, for instance, for a variety of reasons that involved overreactions to different things. But an example, back in 2011, as we know, the much maligned Green Lantern movie.
What movie?
Came into development.
And there was a Green Lantern movie?
A movie that was called Green Lantern and shared some similarities with the concept.
I keyed. sorry, Mike, I didn't mean to offend you if you're listening to this.
But the movie was being developed. Before the movie had even been screened for critics, Warner Brothers greenlit a sequel and hired somebody to start writing. Greenlit. And hired somebody. That's good. Hired somebody to start writing the sequel. The sequel was already written. There was already a treatment for the sequel that was finished, actually, that has leaked since then. They had a sequel script written. They greenlit the whole project and were laying the seeds for a greater DC universe through the inclusion of characters like Amanda Waller, who has absolutely nothing to do with Green Lantern, but they put her in the movie to sow the seeds for a greater DC universe. Well, Green Lantern comes out, makes money, doesn't make as much money as they wanted it to make, and was not, don't get me wrong, wasn't a very good movie, but that movie not being as good as they expected it to be was enough reason for Warner Brothers not only to not do the sequel to Green Lantern, but to scrap all of their plans for a DC extended universe and essentially go right back to the drawing board because one movie did not do what they wanted it to do. So then it became, hey, let's convince Chris Nolan to keep doing Batman movies, when Nolan had made it very clear he was doing three and that was it. So that didn't work out, and then it's like, oh crap, well, time to do our extended universe. And so they have a history of overreacting at a corporate level to things. And that applies to a lot of different divisions of Warner Brothers, because they've put DC in a bind before by overreacting to things. So, I hope that isn't the case in the future.
And it really is. Like, this is something that I harp on and on about with fanboys. It's like whenever they get mad about the movies or TV shows not doing what they want to do, they immediately throw DC under the bus. And I'm like, it's not DC making the decision. DC Comics is just a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. If you want to throw somebody under the bus, go Warner Brothers, not DC Comics. DC Comics guys are very rarely included in the decision-making when it comes to the outside media. But they work on comic books, and that's where they're expected to stay. Maybe that's changing a little bit now that Kevin Tejahara is in charge over at Warner Brothers, which was a good hire. I like that guy. I think that he has a lot of faith in the DC Comics properties.
And they've given more power to Jeff Johns, for instance, who has helped make a lot of these TV projects happen.
And we want to believe, I certainly want to believe that rumor that Jeff Johns and Ben Affleck have total creative control over a solo Batman movie. I want to believe that. I haven't seen anything concrete on that says to me that that's absolutely true. But whoever put that rumor out there first played right on my fanboy heartstrings. You knew exactly what I wanted to hear. And, you know, you're playing me like a harp from hell, if you will. there's you, a Batman Returns reference.
There you go. And I think that actually might be a good segue into our next topic, actually.
Well, Ben Affleck's influence over the future Justice League movies, because he was recently revealed to be made an executive producer on Justice League. And that's pretty big news in my eyes, because as most people know, or at least should know, Ben Affleck's a hell of a director. Go watch movies like Argo and The Town. Go watch Gone Baby Gone. Tremendous filmmaker. Award-winning filmmaker, writer, writer, director, actor, everything. Like, this guy can really do it all. And I would like to think that most people, whenever they saw his take on Batman, were pretty impressed by it. Even people who hated the movie at least had something positive to say about him. So, yep. You know, something good came of it. And if we're getting, you know, that solo Batman movie with him in it, cool. But now we come to that other rumor that's floating out there that DC, well, not DC, but Warner Brothers and Zack Snyder are kind of butting heads over Justice League because Warner Brothers was kind of miffed about Batman v Superman not hitting $1 billion, and they are damn sure wanting Justice League to do it. And they have that expectation there, so they're like, I don't know what they're saying to him. I don't know what conversations are being had or if conversations are even being had on that level, but the addition of Ben Affleck as an executive producer on the film suggests that they want his creative input. So, from my perspective, I think this means that they look at Ben Affleck's storytelling sensibilities and how he structures his movies, and that's basically what they want. They want him to come in and kind of help rein in the just exuberant amount of some often heavy-handed symbolism that can be a Zack Snyder movie. Because, boy, does he love his religious symbolism, which was just everywhere in Batman v Superman. To the point of almost like beating you over the head. You thought Man of Steel was rough about it. Batman v Superman was using it like a tack hammer. Or like an ice pick in the back of your head. So it's like, Zach, I appreciate Zack Snyder's visual sensibilities. I really do. And I even think that the guy has a really great ability to tell a good story. But, you know, he could stand to ease up on the heavy-handedness a bit. And Ben Affleck seems like the guy to come in and say, hey, maybe lay off.
Yeah, I think Ben can ground him a little bit.
That's the idea. So, I mean, what did you think whenever you heard that? Like, what do you think about Affleck's expanding role?
I'm all for it. I mean, I've been a supporter of Affleck for years. I think that the reaction from our comic book community to Affleck's casting when it was announced was embarrassing. I mean, it was embarrassing because it indicated a bunch of people who clearly had not seen a film in the last 10 years that wasn't comic book related.
2003 to like, 10 years. He was cast in 2013, and these people are bringing up Daredevil. I'm like, you fuckers realize that was 2003?
Yeah, and you know, I've always liked the guy, and he does good work. He works hard, and his, like you said, his storytelling sensibilities have shown through in all the movies he's directed. And I think that adding him in will only help if he's included more in the process from both a grounding perspective and, you know, you're talking about Zack and he goes over the top sometimes. I have not hidden the fact that I'm a Zack Snyder fan for the most part. I like most of his movies to varying degrees. I didn't love Batman v Superman, but I think that with Zach, I think he is a great interpreter of other people's ideas. I think back to Watchmen. I think back to Dawn of the Dead. He does a great job of interpreting other people's ideas. I don't think he's a great idea guy on his own, and I think that's where sometimes he maybe his reach exceeds his grasp, or whatever the expression is.
I think that's fair.
And I think that Ben can help rein that in a little bit and help on the idea side to keep things maybe a little less heavy-handed than Zach tends to go. I don't see any downside to this news. I'm excited about it. I think it bodes well. I also think it flies in the face of the ludicrous rumors that have come out about how Affleck is furious about the reception that Batman v Superman got. I'm sure he's upset about it.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah, who wouldn't be? But I don't think it's a situation where he's like, "All right, I'm done. I'm out." I don't think he's going to quit. I think he's all in, and the more power he has, as far as I'm concerned, the better, because he's proven the more accomplished voices you get involved in the process, the better. And I think he's going to help Zach. And I think if you can get a movie where you've got the story sensibilities of Ben Affleck and the visual sensibilities of Zack Snyder, I think you're going to be set.
And we can't forget that, you know, Chris Terrio, when he was brought in to write Batman v Superman, he was actually brought in after the vast majority of that story was already written.
Mm-hmm.
He was brought in to take another swing at the screenplay. So basically it was rework a few scenes and some dialogue, and that's your job. But we're going to give you like the full creative reins over Justice League. So that's, I'm actually kind of excited about him, because I mean, this guy won an Oscar for Argo. He has the ability to write a really great story, and you know, he's taking that job very seriously. And I've read a few interviews with him, and the guy seems to like really be trying to get like deep into some of these characters. But before we even get to Justice League, we've still got Suicide Squad and Wonder Woman to go, which Wonder Woman just wrapped production at the time of this recording, just wrapped up yesterday. And I got to tell you, like, I'm really pumped for that movie. I think that one's going to be a pretty big financial success, and all indications seem to be pointing towards Suicide Squad being a huge hit for them. So
I'm excited for both those movies. They look, yeah. They both look interesting, and they both look different, and different in a good way. So
yeah, they're
really excited.
Trying different aesthetics, trying different things, and I think that both of these movies are going to succeed. Oddly enough, they may succeed where Batman v Superman failed, and that's with critics. And they may be even looked at more favorably through audiences. I mean, sure, these movies are still going to piss off somebody. That's just par for the course. You know, unless you're making a Disney and Marvel film, which means you're just going to like knock it out of the park every time. Speaking of which, we had another movie open up this past weekend, and pretty sure most of you've seen it by now.
And that, of course, being Weekend at Bernie's 3.
That's still in my queue, as it were, to watch, because I'm notoriously slow about keeping up with TV shows. That's not true at all, because I obsessively watch Flash and Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow. I can't deny my fanboyism. Shouts to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You suck. Totally kidding, but not really. Bring back Agent Carter, you bastards. Anyway, that movie being Captain America Civil War. And I don't think it has to, I think it should have gone without saying at the beginning of this podcast, but let's just go ahead and put it out there. Spoiler alert, we're going to spoil the hell out of this movie. Where we're not like giving a reaction. This is not a review. I already did that.
Check it out, placetobenation.com. Yeah,
check it out. I reviewed that one too. And hey, again, Ben Morris, I don't hate Marvel movies. I love them. Check out my review. You'll see how much I loved Captain America Civil War. It's a 4.5-star out of 5 review. Come on now. I freaking loved that movie. Greg, I think you were on the same page with me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was actually better than I thought it was. I thought it would be good. But it was better than I thought it was going to be, because I had concerns about how they'd balance all these characters, how heavy-handed they'd go with the story, and it exceeded all my expectations. And again, folks, if you're worried about spoilers, you might want to stop here, because we are going to be talking about some things that happened during the movie.
Oh, we're about to go for it pretty soon. This is your final warning. If you don't want spoilers, you might as well abandon ship now. So let's just get into it. Let's talk about, like, we're not reviewing the movie. We're not going to give like full reaction. Let's kind of get to some future talk, because you know, we could analyze the movie back and forth all day, but I actually felt like this was the first time in a long time that the post-credit scenes, both of them, yes, there are two, both of them felt relevant and felt like they really meant something for the movies going forward. It wasn't that thing that they've been doing lately, or that they did all the way through phase two, which was a mid-credit scene, which kind of set up the next movie, or at least set some groundwork for what's to come, followed by an actual post-credit scene, which was just kind of some silliness, like an interdimensional alien dog chasing a bird. Thor: The Dark World. I mean, we sat all the way through the credits for that. Was it funny? Sure. Did I need to sit through the credits for that? No. Why did you do that? But this time, no. We saw something cool in that mid-credit scene. You get our first look at Wakanda. Now, we don't see it through the whole movie. But then, they showed you that Wakanda is the most technologically advanced society on the planet, and I'm so happy they played that idea up. I mean,
the line when Black Panther says, "Let them come."
Oh,
let them try, you know, tremendous.
Oh, that was that Chadwick Boseman. I can't say enough good about that guy. Stole the movie. I mean, for me anyway. It's between him and Tom Holland.
They were both great, yeah.
Oh, just tremendous. I mean, Tom Holland has arrived, folks. That guy, he is Spider-Man. And we'll get to his scene in a minute. His post-credit scene, because that's right, he's at the end. I'm talking about, seeing Wakanda, and that moment when Bucky, you know, he's had his arm, like, blasted off by Iron Man in the final battle. The metal arm, not the fleshy, his actual arm. But he's like, you know, until they can deprogram me from ever going like Winter Soldier on somebody again, I need to stay here in Wakanda on ice. It's a good place for me to hide out. But it, you know, this movie did something that I didn't expect it to do. It didn't kill Cap. It didn't kill Iron Man. It didn't kill anybody. Honestly, none of the main characters died. All the Avengers are still alive. The only person who died in the movie, other than, you know, lots of innocent civilians and a whole bunch of collateral damage, was Peggy Carter. Really emotional scene in there, by the way. That was touching. But
totally.
But now we're at this point where, you know, Tony and the government are clearly not going to be getting along all that well, but Cap is going to be a wanted fugitive. And if you look at the slate of upcoming movies that are coming out, you know, we got Doctor Strange coming up next, and we got a Spider-Man movie coming out next year. Greg, where do you think they're going with this, man? Where do you hope they're going with this? What do you think is the future of Marvel Phase 3?
Well, obviously, it's all heading into Infinity War, which, as many may know from listening to previous podcasts or reading our columns, is my most anticipated Marvel movie, because I've been dreaming of seeing Thanos and the Infinity Gauntlet on the big screen since I was about 7 years old, give or take. So that's going to be awesome whenever that happens. But this movie, that's what surprised me about this, is this didn't feel like set up for Infinity War. This felt almost like you could do years and years of movies just off of the fallout of this, because just a short list of notes that I made about character angles that have to be followed up on now after Civil War. Scarlet Witch and Vision.
God, yes.
What's going on there? You know, obviously there's people that know the comics history, know the history of Scarlet Witch and Vision, but in the movie, there's definitely something there. You know, Vision is trying to create what he views humanity as, to become closer to being human. Scarlet Witch is terrified of the amount of power that she has. That's going to be an interesting dynamic of how do they grow together. Do they grow together, especially after what she did in the movie when she really took him out? They're on opposite sides, technically. Vision, of course, is with the licensed, sanctioned Avengers. Scarlet Witch is now part of Cap's secret Avengers, for lack of a better term. And that's the next thing, is Cap's, quote-unquote, secret Avengers. You know, you could almost do an entire movie about Cap and his rogue squadron of Avengers going around, you know, trying to avoid the loving embrace of Thunderbolt Ross and the government. And that, okay, you know,
that kind of seems like it could be like an undercurrent in the Phase 3 movies, like, you know, Tony and Cap trying to go around and basically recruit more people to their side. Like, as each of these movies come out, like, of course, I'm wondering how Spider-Man is going to factor in, like with Spider-Man Homecoming, since it's been confirmed that that Tony Stark will appear in that movie. Please hook up with Marissa Tomei.
Yes, Yes, I know. I think we all saw the sparks there.
Their chemistry was just sparking. It was like starting a fire in that living room.
It's interesting. I feel like the Cap and or not the Cap, but the Tony and Peter relationship is going to be interesting to watch, because I almost feel, you know, Peter obviously is missing that male authority figure in his life, that older brother or that father figure in his life. Tony, as we saw in Iron Man 3, relates to young people really well in a way, because he also has daddy issues.
Oh yeah.
And now, especially with the guilt that he feels of that young man that was killed in the wake of Age of Ultron, which was brought up in Civil War, I think Tony and Peter are both going to be looking to fill roles in their lives with each other, and I think it's going to be really interesting to watch.
It's either that or Tony Stark is going to wind up stripping in Vegas, because, I mean, that's what you do when you have such severe daddy issues. And the thing is, as I was watching, Robert Downey Jr.'s chemistry with Tom Holland, they were on point with each other.
Yep.
It was just fire. You know, like, everything about this is clicking. And I don't know who to... we can credit that to the actors, and I want to give them the vast majority of the credit for capturing their character so well. But shouts to the Russos for pulling this off in such glorious fashion, because this could have been a disaster. And it was the opposite.
Absolutely. One thing I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Do you think that Doctor Strange is going to tie into these events closely, or do you think it'll mostly kind of do its own thing, or do you see it tying more into the central thread?
I think it's going to probably wind up doing mostly its own thing, kind of like how Guardians of the Galaxy did, but with a loose tie to the rest of it. But it will be based on Earth, so we have to tie. Doctor Strange has to be tied to that larger universe, to certainly more closely than what Guardians of the Galaxy is. I just use that as an example to say that this movie does its own thing. It plays by its own rules in a lot of ways, but it can easily be part of the larger MCU when the time comes. Doctor Strange should probably do that same thing. It's got a total Inception meets Batman Begins thing going on right now. So clearly somebody over the MCU said, maybe we should make our own version of a Christopher Nolan movie. I think we're going to get it in Doctor Strange.
I think so too.
And it's going to be cool. Like, I'm pretty pumped for it. And I'm not even a Doctor Strange fan. Although, to give a little callback to that Doctor Strange animated movie from a few years ago, that was really good.
I agree.
I'm pretty excited to see what they do with this movie. They've certainly got the look down, and Benedict Cumberbatch is, you know, a pretty reliable actor when it comes to this, and man, he looks the part.
Totally.
After
Civil War, man, the Marvel's casting gets no doubts from me, because they've done a spectacular job of casting these characters so far.
Oh, none whatsoever. And I feel like, you know, the thing is, we don't know where Doctor Strange takes place, because Stephen Strange was mentioned in Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
I totally forgot about that.
He was called out by name as a potential threat, as one of the targets for the I don't remember the name of the system they used. It's neither here nor there now, but it's the, you know, all those floating airships that were going to start targeting people. Hydra was going to use at least, you know, one of them to take out Doctor Strange. So that says to me that this movie may even be a bit of a prequel.
I could easily see that, and I think that almost might be a good way to go about it, because right now, I mean, they're clicking on all cylinders, but I think that they're going to have to slow down a little bit to introduce some of these characters, and I think that in particular the case of Doctor Strange, you're talking about a character that I think the general audience probably doesn't know a whole lot about. I'll admit, even I don't know a whole lot about him, so I'm interested to see, you know, introduction of who he is, how he gets his powers, things like that. And but you're probably right. They'll probably play it a little bit like Guardians in terms of doing its own thing, and then maybe as the movie gets closer to its climax, tying it in more with the central themes of the MCU.
That's what I'm hoping for, and maybe a post-credit scene similar to, like, it feels like they're trying to, you know, introduce some new heroes into this mix instead of just doing a bunch of sequels.
Mm-hmm.
And far be it of me to tell them to make Iron Man again, because they just did that when they made Ant-Man. they did. I'm sorry, but Ant-Man and Iron Man are the same damn movie. That's just the way that goes. But that, I mean, that's their formula. That's the base formula. But what I think they should do with Doctor Strange is kind of pull an Iron Man. Like, give us an origin movie that is kind of a prequel, but inject some hard Christopher Nolan sensibility into it. And don't be afraid of going, like, and they clearly aren't afraid of going hard into the magical side of this universe, which is something they have not explored yet. So essentially what they could do for Doctor Strange is the same thing. Like, they could do for magic what Iron Man did for technology in the MCU. You could have a character that gets people really interested in that, and suddenly Doctor Strange is no longer a B-list player. He's graduated up to the A-list.
And just imagine if they do knock this out of the park and establish Doctor Strange. They've already established Black Panther. Ryan Coogler attached to direct, I can only assume that movie's going to rock. Spider-Man looks like it's going to rock. Now, if worse comes to worse and Robert Downey Jr. finally says, all right, I'm done. If Chris Evans finally says, all right, I'm done. If Chris Hemsworth says, all right, I'm done. If all that happens, you will instead of having to recast these iconic characters, you can easily continue the MCU with a new batch, a new generation of heroes, Captain Marvel.
New Avengers, if you will.
A new Avengers, exactly. Yeah. And you could even, you know, because it sounds like everybody has fun making these movies, so you could probably convince Evans and Downey to come back and do Avengers movies once in a while and not do solo movies, and spend your solo movies on Spider-Man, Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange. There's any number of great Marvel properties that haven't even been in a movie yet.
And let's not forget that... if you want to start, like, I mean, don't do it right now, but if you wanted to start graduating up some of those people from the Netflix shows on into the main MCU, why
Absolutely.
Not?
100%.
You could easily do that later. I mean, don't do it right now. Wait.
One thing that I want to see, since they don't have the rights to the X-Men, I would love to see John Bernthal's Punisher fill in for Wolverine and in a Spider-Man-Wolverine dynamic between them.
Punisher's first appearance was in a Spider-Man comic.
Exactly.
He appeared as a villain, so why not have him, like, show up? Like, you can do that. You can put him in a Spider-Man movie as a, you know, a secondary villain, or as a guy who's just, you know, misunderstanding the situation.
Having the ultra-serious Frank interact with the completely non-serious Peter in costume, I think could be great, because that's what I always enjoy about the Wolverine-Spider-Man interactions in the comics, is Spider-Man's such a prankster, and Wolverine is about as far removed from that as it gets.
Exactly.
So it's always a great dynamic.
It would be so much fun to watch those two play off of each other. I would love to see the Netflix version of Daredevil interacting with some of these characters. I would love to have him and Chris Evans have a conversation together as, like, Cap and Daredevil. I think that would be... a really interesting thing for them to do. And of course, we all know that they're introducing Captain Marvel pretty soon, who rumor has it, or like, I guess it may have even been confirmed, that she's going to be in Avengers. Of course, she's in Infinity War, but I wanted to say she's in one of these movies prior to that. But I don't remember which one right now, so I'm just going to, like, stop there. But anyway, Captain Marvel coming in that's pretty huge. I mean, they haven't done a solo female hero movie.
No.
And that's kind of shocking in a lot of ways, considering that, you know, Black Widow's been in this since Iron Man 2. And still.
Oh, absolutely. And as much as, I mean, hey, more power to him for doing a Captain Marvel movie. I'm sure it's going to be great, and that's good news. I'm a little peeved that we are getting a Captain Marvel movie before a Black Widow movie, because
I'm right there with
you.
I feel
like Scarlett Johansson has been in from the ground floor and has kind of been passed over a few times for some of these solo projects.
Yeah, she has. It really sucks that they have not given her a solo film yet. When they're like, and especially in Age of Ultron, when they start delving into her history a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You start seeing stuff like that, and it's like, wow, what is this story? Tell me more. I gots to know.
I mean, suckers gots to know.
I gots to know. I gots to know what this is about. And I know some people are like, well, they should do a Black Widow Hawkeye movie. Man, forget that. I don't care about Jeremy Renner. like I didn't come to see him. Like, I came to see Scarlett Johansson because, well, Black Widow is, I'm sorry, Kelly, my buddy out there who's a big Hawkeye fan, but Black Widow is far more interesting of a character. And, I mean, it's Scarlett Johansson and that ass. I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that, actually. Dead ass.
and, men across America.
Straight men across America agree with me, dead ass. But on top of that, she embodies the character of Black Widow in the same way that Robert Downey Jr. embodies the character of Iron Man. Like, could you imagine somebody else doing it?
No, and in some ways she's even added, as a lot of these actors have in the MCU, she's even added a layer of humanity to Black Widow that was often missing in a lot of the comics. And I would love to see a Black Widow standalone movie. I think there's a lot of room there. And you can even have Hawkeye in it, but it shouldn't be Black Widow and Hawkeye. It should just be Black Widow.
Right, Hawkeye should be relegated to supporting cast.
Yeah, you could put Hawkeye in the role that Black Widow served in Winter Soldier, or that she served in Iron Man 2.
Iron Man 2 works better. That's because... Now, relegate him back to his cameo appearance in the first Thor movie. Take that, you useless bastard.
Clint becomes the... which, by the way, one of the things that I would also love to see coming out of this is... Since Marvel is having so much success on the small screen on Netflix, I would love to see a Hawkeye TV show on Netflix that's kind of in the vein of the Matt Fraction Hawkeye.
Oh, I'm totally with you.
Yeah, that looks at what is Hawkeye's life when he's not with the Avengers, just doing everyday chores and you know, normal life.
You know what? That series would be awesome. I would watch every single episode of it. That's where I could watch an entire series of Hawkeye. Just nothing but Hawkeye would be that. But if they make that show and they don't give us the purple Hawkeye head sensor bar at some point, I'm sorry, you have failed. To channel Stephen Amell, you have failed the fandom if you don't put that in your show.
And David Sunday, I'm sure you're listening to this out there. That one was for you, my friend. I know how much you love the Hawkeye head over the crotch of Mr. Barton. So.
Hey, he ain't the only one. We're all loving that. That's hilarious. Right. That you can't have a Hawkeye series and not do that. I mean, come on. How are you not going to put that in there? But that's our thoughts on. I guess actually we could go a little bit further. I mean, Infinity War is going to be this huge thing. They said they're going to retitle. The Russos recently said they're going to retitle those Avengers movies. Like, one of them is probably going to be called Infinity War, but they, you know, we don't know what the other one's going to be called because they're going to be separate movies. They're not going to be just like one movie they film all at once and then split in two, which is the smarter idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got movies that are going to be coming in between that. I think Captain Marvel is one of those. And she absolutely... you know, has to be introduced prior to that. She's definitely not in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, because James Gunn has already said that she's not in there. But he's not really playing in their sandbox, so it really wouldn't make a ton of sense to do that. But where would you, like, how would you introduce Captain Marvel? Like, that's going to be, I think that's going to be, like, their biggest challenge is not so much, like, putting her in a movie, but figuring out how they want to do it.
I think that you got a couple of opportunities, perhaps with a Thor movie, with Ragnarok, you would have an opportunity.
That's a good
there.
Point. There you go.
And if not there, then perhaps in the Black Panther movie. But I think Thor might be a good chance to introduce her. Although, don't get me, you know, I say that, and I'm really hoping that almost all of the Thor movie doesn't take place on Earth.
Oh no, I want this whole thing in Asgard.
Absolutely, I think that's the way to go about it. And, you know, so that would make it harder to introduce Captain Marvel. But, you know, especially if she works with S.W.O.R.D. or whatever, and you know, there's a lot of ways to introduce her from that perspective. Black Panther would be an opportunity there. Probably not. I can't really see a chance in Spider-Man to do it.
Spider-Man is going to be mostly a Sony picture anyway, so it's probably not going to have as much, like, as his solo movies go, it probably isn't going to have as much bearing on the larger MCU as the other films are. You know, because that's Sony doing their thing still, but they get to play around with, you know, MCU producers and writers, so that's going to help them.
Yeah, that's going to help a lot. And you know, I think that those are your two to look at. Thor and Black Panther would be the two movies to, I think, look for her to possibly be introduced in.
I'm gonna vote Thor. That's just my perspective.
Yeah. Hey, why not? You know. And then you've got, you know, I'm looking forward to. I think it's gonna be great whenever they're doing such a good job of keeping them separate that whenever the Guardians characters do finally interact with the Avengers characters, it's gonna be a blast.
Oh, for sure. I mean, once they figure out a way to put the Guardians, I mean, clearly it's going to be the Thanos tie-in. I mean, because Thanos is the glue that will bring all this together, and maybe we will finally have a Marvel movie villain who is so intriguing and so awesome that we want to see more of him because we haven't had one since Loki.
Yeah.
Although I will give them credit for not killing Zemo in Captain America's Civil War. That was a good choice, because he needs to come back. We need to see more of him. Super talented actor, that guy.
They could easily use him to put together a what is the anti-Avengers group called? I'm blanking on it right now.
You ain't the only one.
The Masters of Evil. obviously not called that in the movie, but a version of that. Where they could use them to put together the Thunderbolts, which I saw bandied about online, which would be an interesting thing to do.
I could totally see him doing Thunderbolts. If Sony is kind of adamant that Spider-Man villains don't get to appear in the larger MCU, why not have Zemo take over the Norman Osborn role and create the Dark Avengers at some point? That could be another twist on that, and one that I could easily accept. Like I would be really up for seeing that, because honestly I just want to see some more of him, because when he was on screen he was really intriguing. He was somebody that I wanted to see more of, and I just felt like
good actor. And, too,
oh, tremendous actor. If you haven't seen Inglourious Basterds, go watch that movie. He's supremely, like, charming and creepy, all in the same scene too.
Yeah.
But the every time he was on screen in Civil War, this is the only time that I'm going to, like, kind of be a little critical of Civil War, is that I felt like he wasn't fleshed out enough. Like, we weren't there to see him. We were there to see the fight between Captain America and Iron Man. That was the show. And we got a show. We got a hell of a show. But the villain wound up being more than a little underwritten as a result. The actor did the job wonderfully. The script and story didn't really, like, serve him quite as well as it should have. But luckily for the smart people who are making these Marvel movies, they didn't kill him off, which would suggest he's going to be back. Because any time that they've left their villains alive, they've come back. There's been more for them to do. There's more of a role for this character to play. And I mean, Zemo is a pretty major Captain America villain. So to get rid of him, it'd be like, come on, you guys are kind of shooting yourselves in the foot a little bit. You already got rid of the Red Skull. I mean, Captain America's rogues gallery ain't exactly deep. So keep the good ones around. That's a good one. So,
yep.
But yeah, there's tons of possibility there. Like I see, like I'm excited to see Andy Serkis back as Claw in the Black Panther movie. Honestly, because got that little taste of him in Avengers: Age of Ultron when you and I sat down to watch it prior to seeing Civil War, and it reminded me of just how awesome and like creepy he is as a villain. Man, that guy's making a living off of playing villains.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting to see him play one in live action finally.
Yeah, and his actual speaking voice, that'll throw you. I'm used to hearing him as Gollum, and
yep.
And then you hear his deep, like, I couldn't tell his accent, maybe Australian. I'm gonna be wrong on that, aren't I?
I don't know.
But that accent was there. I was like, well, this is, or maybe he's English or British. Garner's gonna, like, hate me for this. But he's also, he does the voice of Supreme Leader Snoke in Star Wars The Force Awakens and the continuing Star Wars trilogy. So he's, this guy
also gets, he did the lead ape in the Planet of the Apes reboot.
Yes. He plays Caesar in the Planet of the Apes films. And does a tremendous job of it too. Those movies are actually mm-hmm. very, very good. I like both of them a lot. But anyway, that's lots and lots of possibilities for all of this going forward. And of course, we're always keeping our ears to the ground for any and all news that's coming out, because we're going to jump on it as soon as it does and start telling people about it, because that's what we like to do. That's our thing. Greg, anything else you want to add about the MCU Phase 3 or Phase 4?
No, I think we've pretty well hit the main marks on it. I just want to, you know, again, commend Marvel and everybody that's working on these movies for doing a hell of a job, for putting their all into the movies, into the promotion of the movies. Keep them coming. I mean, as long as you keep pumping them out, I'm going to keep coming out to the movie theater and giving my hard-earned money over to watch them. So. Looking forward to seeing where they go with all this, and excited for the future after Civil War. It really, really lit a fire under me to see where they're going and to see some of these new characters that have been introduced.
Oh, and same here. Like, there's so much to love there, and we're running real short of time. But I did want to get in one final thing, because I just like hearing Greg geek out over this. Because he will. Wolverine 3. That is totally happening. And they are going old man Logan with it. Going into that sci-fi western. And not only that, they're going R-rated with it. And it's not just because of the success of Deadpool. They've been talking about going R-rated with Wolverine for years. They wanted to do it with the last Wolverine movie, but the studio kind of hemmed and hawed with them a little bit. You still got an R-rated director's cut, though. And, yeah, it's a bit bloody. But this time, oh no, going for it. And they have said that outright. Greg, unleash your happy on these poor people.
Yee! I'm so happy. I really am, though. Everybody must know out there. Everybody must know. Wolverine is my favorite Marvel character. Has been since I was a little kid. I don't think it'll ever change. I have loved Hugh Jackman's portrayal of Wolverine in these movies. I am so stoked for this. And in fact, if you've listened to by the time this goes up, you will have already heard the latest Hard Traveling Fanboys, where I discuss that Eric LaSalle from Coming to America has been cast in Wolverine 3, which I'm stoked about. This is just a love letter to Wolverine fans, I think. In many ways, in my opinion, The Wolverine, the Japanese saga, was also a love letter to Wolverine fans that love that Chris Claremont, Frank Miller classic. But Old Man Logan is the other just standout Wolverine story that has not been committed to film. And I am so excited to see where they go with this. It's going to have a Western feel to it. It's going to have, presumably, I'm hoping we'll finally get to see Omega Red, who's one of the big Wolverine villains that hasn't been filmed yet. I'm just really excited about this, and I have nothing but love for Hugh Jackman. I think he's one of the best to ever do it in a superhero movie. And so, I can't say enough about that.
Hugh Jackman's been at it a long time. This guy has committed himself to playing Wolverine. He's been doing it since 2000.
That's amazing. And to keep himself in the kind of shape that he does, it would be, I mean, if I were him, I'd be tired of it by now, trying to keep my body in that kind of condition. But he keeps coming. He keeps putting out quality work. He doesn't hide from it. He doesn't run from it. He embraces it. He loves comic book fans. He's a great example to other people that do comic book movies.
Because, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's not a good guy. He's the guy. That's still the stupidest catchphrase they've come up with yet. It's only slightly better than believe that. But I'm sorry, Roman Reigns. I don't hate you like that. I don't hate you like other people do, but geez, man, they got to get you some better writers. but in any case, like we're on the cusp of a new X-Men movie too. Like speaking of Wolverine, you know, X-Men Apocalypse is out in a couple of weeks. I'm kind of shocked. Critics are already hating on it. Like 50-50 split, and I'm really taken aback. I'm like, what? What is this? Like, Days of Future Past was, you know, it wasn't quite, I'll put it this way, it was not quite as good as X2, but it was knocking on the door.
It was. It got huge positive reactions from critics, from audiences, from everybody.
It did. Like, that was, I mean, Bryan Singer's triumphant return to the X-Universe. And what a return it was. And that's why I have a hard time believing that X-Men Apocalypse is as bad as some of these folks have said it is. I mean, I'm looking at the trailers and I'm like, this looks pretty good to me.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm digging a lot of the actors that they've got cast in these roles too. Like, cause it's always difficult whenever you recast somebody, you know, like you're recasting Jean Grey and Cyclops specifically, or even more
and
so,
Storm.
And Storm. That's another big one. The other big one for me is Nightcrawler, because Alan Cumming, you know, he embodied Nightcrawler.
Oh, he was outstanding. He absolutely.
He knocked that out of the freaking park. I could not believe how good he was, and still, I still look at that performance and I'm like just blown away by it. But I've seen some clips of the new kid and listened to him talk. He's got the accent down. He's got the demeanor, and I'm digging him. You know, like I think that this casting for Nightcrawler seems pretty good to me so far. And the same with Storm. I actually think that the Storm casting is good. She's got she can actually do an accent and do it well.
Yeah, I think that this is actually probably going to be a better Storm. And no knock on Halle. I like Halle Berry fine, but she
Halle.
You know, I think. I think that this is actually going to be a more comic book like version of Storm than we've seen before. I already like the costume they've given her and the costume they've given Psylocke certainly, and also Cyclops as well.
Yeah, they've become like if you look at from 2000 to now, they have become more and more comic book like as they've gone along, and X-Men Apocalypse, like the costumes that they're using, this is as close as we've ever seen them to looking like they're straight out of the comics. And if they stay on this route, if they go into that next movie being like a 90s X-Men movie, which, you know, gave both of us a bit of a fangasm, if they go full 90s with it and bring out those costumes, oh, we're just going to lose it. We'll make that movie a hit just from repeat viewings just to see more of those costumes in live action.
I hope the movie is good, and I hope it delivers, because there's so much more room to expand the X-Men universe. I mean, there's so many great villains they've never even. I mean, to get a proper Juggernaut, to get
if I don't get Mr. Sinister sometimes,
Mr.
soon, I'm
Sinister.
Lose it.
I was about to say Mr. Sinister. Absolutely.
That's my number one wish list item for a future X-Men movie is Mr. Sinister. And there's so many good stories that they could adapt. I mean, my number one choice for like a 90s X-Men movie is for them to adapt like a Mutant Massacre, which I think would be
That would be so good.
And that's a Mr. Sinister story. That would be a great introduction for him. I mean, the real challenge there is if they want to even try to recast Wolverine. And all I can say to you is maybe no, maybe don't.
Yeah, it's going to be real hard, and sometimes when it's that hard, it's best just to think, because Lord knows there's no shortage of X-Men characters.
there's
so many mutants out there. You know, there's always stand-ins you can have. You know, people that can fill that void that will be left behind by anybody that you take out of the movie.
And you know what? The thing is, like, we have so many more like tools to use now than we ever have in making movies. And you know what? If they can make Robert Downey Jr. look like he's all of 20 years old again for Civil War, you can de-age Hugh Jackman and make him
absolutely.
Look, you could totally de-age Hugh Jackman digitally.
They could, and that
back that money totally, truck up and keep him coming back.
as far as I'm concerned, totally.
I mean, that's the thing. Wasn't that the most impressive CGI? That was the most impressive CGI of the entire Civil War to me, was when I didn't know who that was at first. I was like, is that Robert Downey Jr.'s voice that I'm hearing? You know, his face is covered. Then as soon as he stands up, I'm like, he's straight out of 1983.
Yeah, it's incredible. It was like you took him off the set of you know, one of his 80s movies. It was incredible.
I was so taken aback. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. They pulled this off. And it was believable. It didn't look fake. It looked legit. It was real. It was like...
It did.
It wasn't makeup effect either. It was CGI. And he looked like... They even did... When they got on the close-up, I couldn't even tell that it was CG anymore. I was like, this is amazing. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. He looks 20 years old again. And it's him. Like, Hugh Jackman. They can totally do that to your face, you know? They could de-age you back to... Like your 30s or maybe your 20s, you know, now you really do not have to age. I mean, that's probably crazy talk. I mean, I don't know how much money they have to work with here. They probably don't have Disney money. Even though it is Fox, but still, that's really cool. You know, that they're continuing on it. And I know that you and I both are looking forward to X-Men Apocalypse. We're going to be seeing it in a couple of weeks. Watch out for my review right here on placetobenation.com. Surprise announcement! As if that was a surprise. I totally review all of these comic book movies now. And, you know, maybe I'll be doing some of the others too. You just got to keep a watch out. But, I mean, somebody is going to be reviewing these movies. We're not going to just let that go by. that would be crazy talk. But... Speaking of crazy talk, we've been doing it a lot here for the last like almost couple of hours, so probably about time to wrap up this inaugural edition of Sellers Points podcast. But as I do, I want to leave you with a final point, the final Sellers Point of the day, and it's the same one that I'm going to leave you with at the end of every show. The first thing, let's put it to you this way: simply be good fans. And by being good fans, I mean spread the love of what you love. Find something that you enjoy. It doesn't matter which comic it is. It doesn't matter which TV show it is. If you love it with everything you've got. And then tell people about it. Spread that. We got enough hate in the world. Freaking Donald Trump is a Republican presidential front, is now the nominee for the Republican Party. There's plenty of hate in the world, folks. We don't need any more of it. We're full up. You know, if hate were a stock, it would be plummeting right now because the market's flooded. So let's try something different. Let's stand out from the crowd a little bit. Tell people about what you love. Spread that. Be better fans. Be great fans. And as the late, great George Carlin once said, be excellent to each other. And that is my final point. I want to say another big thanks to Greg Phillips, one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Make sure you check out their podcast. It's every week right here at placetobenation.com. Place to Be Network, where you can find all the, like, not just all this crazy comic book and movies talk that we do, but you can also get your like really great sports news. And, of course, the many, many great wrestling podcasts that you can get out there and articles. There's really no shortage of it, whether you're a fan of the current run or a fan of you know, the bygone eras. There's something here for you. You will not leave this site disappointed. And if you do, just come see me and I'll give you your money back. If you spent any. Why would you do that? Unless you just want to donate to us. We'll take it.
Hey, contributions will not be declined.
They really will not be, but on that note, all sales are final. And that's going to be my sign-off. All sales are final. Sellers Points is done for this week, this month, actually. This is going to be a monthly podcast, so I'll see you back next month. I'll see if I can con Greg into coming back. If he can't, well, it'll just be me. And I'll be regaling you with wonderful tales of my comic fandom and all the crazy stuff that happens within the next month. So until then, folks, this is Russell Sellers signing off, saying goodnight to you. Say goodnight, Gracie, and that means you, Greg.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Russell. I really appreciate it, and thanks to all the people out there for listening.
All right, we will see you guys next time. And we out.